This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 8th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a Department of Justice report finds widespread abuse and corruption on the part of Puerto Rico's police force. We'll have the details. In Washington, the committee charged with cutting government debt meets for the first time. And we'll speak to a prominent human rights lawyer in Pakistan about the impact of September 11th on her country. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, Palestinians kicked off their UN statehood bid with a ceremony in the West Bank city of Ramallah. A group of activists delivered a letter to a UN office there, announcing their intentions and asking for support. Because of failed face-to-face negotiations with Israel, the Palestinians are trying to gain legitimacy directly through the UN. While they do have significant support among member nations, several countries, like the U.S., oppose the move. U.S. Envoy David Hale met Wednesday with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, but was unsuccessful in dissuading the course of action. The U.S., for its part, has been unbending in its stance on the Palestinian plans. At a Senate confirmation hearing, State Department nominee Wendy Sherman said the U.S. is ready to use its U.N. veto power.
The administration has been very clear as well. And I don't expect this to occur, but that if it did occur, if any such resolution were put in front of the Security Council, that we would veto it. So our expectation is that will not occur. But the General Assembly is still of concern.
Palestinians intend to travel to the UN later this month to officially request statehood. Dozens of schools in the Mexican resort city of Acapulco have yet to open for the year due to extortion threats against teachers. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
Mexican public schools began the academic year August 29th, but at least 52 schools in Acapulco remain shuttered due to extortion threats targeting teachers and schools in the city's rural outskirts and working-class neighborhoods. Earlier this week, the Guerrero state governor announced a major security operation would protect the city's schools and ordered teachers back to work. He also questioned the authenticity of the flyers that have circulated threatening school staff. One such flyer, supposedly received by a financial administrator in the public school system, demanded a full list of all employees who make more than the equivalent of $1,500 a month, along with copies of their official identification, home addresses, places of employment, and landline phone numbers. The letter demanded payment of half of the teachers' salaries by October 1st. The state's teachers union met with federal authorities Wednesday to discuss possible security measures. But for now, teachers are continuing with their de facto strike. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Supporters of Troy Davis have been struggling to save him from execution in Georgia for more than two decades. This week, officials once again signed his death warrant and set an execution date. But advocates for Davis say there's still hope. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
If the Georgia Department of Corrections has its way, Troy Anthony Davis will be executed at 7 p.m. on September 21st. But Amnesty International and other human rights groups are mobilizing grassroots support to appeal for clemency from the State Board of Pardons and Paroles. Laura Moy of Amnesty International's Death Penalty Abolition Campaign says the weak case against Davis makes her hopeful for clemency.
There are more than just a few doubts about Troy Davis's guilt. His case has really come unraveled. I mean, you have all of these witnesses who have recanted, and there's really no physical evidence that implicates him anymore. I think that there is a reasonable chance that Troy Davis could be given clemency.
Davis has survived three previous execution dates during his time on death row. Since his legal appeals are now exhausted, including an unsuccessful Supreme Court bid in March, the parole board is his last chance to be spared from execution. Amnesty International is planning a global day of solidarity for September 16th, with a march in Georgia and other events for Davis around the world. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A dispute between the Central Michigan University Faculty Association and the university administration has made CMU the latest battleground for workers' rights. On Wednesday, members of the faculty union marched across the Mount Pleasant campus, showing their anger after President George Ross gave his State of the University speech. From Michigan, FSRN's Nate Bender reports.
CMU faculty members have been working without a contract since June 30th. The Faculty Association asserts that the university is financially healthy, but university administration has not budged, saying it wants to maintain a conservative approach to finances. In a response statement issued Wednesday, CMU Faculty Association President Laura Fry said that the university is suffering from a, quote, leadership deficit crisis and has called on the Board of Trustees to resolve the impasse. The two sides have been unable to agree on compensation and benefits. In late August, members of the union held a walkout which disrupted classes on campus, but protests broke down when a judge ordered them back to work. Nate Bender, FSRN, Michigan.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama is scheduled to address the nation tonight in a special session of Congress. The focus will be on job creation, and it comes as the Joint Congressional Committee, charged with cutting more than $1 trillion in spending, gets to work. That committee met today for the first time, and Matt Laszlo has the details.
Congress is back from a month-long vacation in August, and now the Joint Congressional Committee begins its work. The committee is comprised of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, half from the Senate and half from the House. They face a behemoth task, coming up with a plan to trim around $1.5 trillion from the deficit by Thanksgiving. Democratic Washington State Senator Patty Murray is one of the committee's co-chairs. At the inaugural public meeting, she urged her colleagues to leave partisanship at the door.
This committee is made up of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans. We each come to this task with our own strong set of principles, beliefs, and priorities for the country that we love. And while none of us will ever set aside or betray our principles, we must keep in mind there is much more that binds us as Americans than divides us. And we must all be open to compromise and to the ideas and viewpoints of others.
Texas Republican Congressperson Jeb Henschling is the other co-chair of the committee. With the president expected to urge Congress to infuse hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy this evening, Henschling argued that jobs can be created if the committee merely slashes federal spending.
I would hope it would be obvious to all that deficit reduction and a path to fiscal sustainability are themselves a jobs program.
That argument was reiterated by the other 5 Republicans on the committee. Michigan Congressperson Dave Camp put it this way.
The problem we face is obvious. There's too much government spending and too much federal debt, which are impeding our economy's ability to grow. As a result, too few private sector jobs are being created.
That line of argument was rejected by some onlookers as a band of protesters interrupted Camp at the hearing with loud chants of, "What do we want? Jobs. When do we want them? Now."
Please, if the staff will shut the doors.
Henschling called the committee back to order. Afterwards, California Democratic Congressperson Xavier Becerra told the committee that spending cuts could hurt the more than 14 million Americans who are out of work.
We should set out to ensure that any plan we propose does not get in the way of any American willing to work from getting a job. But that's only part of the solution. We must achieve balance, policies that promote economic recovery and investment with smart, responsible, long-term deficit reduction.
Up until this point, Republican Party leaders have reaffirmed their opposition to raising any taxes as a part of the deal. But Montana Democratic Senator Max Baucus says it's impossible to cut more than $1 trillion from the debt without bringing in new revenue streams.
We have to be balanced, clearly. We have to be fair. We have to include revenues. It's not just spending. It also is revenues.
Republicans are calling for entitlement reforms to be a part of the mix. But South Carolina Democratic Congressperson James Clyburn is calling for compassionate budget cuts.
Any solution to our debt problems must be fair. It is just plain wrong to put all the burden of debt and deficit reduction on the elderly, the middle class, and the poor.
Tonight, the president lays out his jobs agenda, which will have to be melded into the committee's work if the jobs plan is to be passed into law. The committee now has about 6 weeks to work out an agreement and send it to the whole Congress for approval. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
On FSRN, we have continued to bring you reports on protests in Puerto Rico over the past couple years. There, the police force has used violence against students and workers calling for reforms. Today, the Department of Justice released a 3-year-long investigation into the Puerto Rico Police Department. It found that officers have engaged in a pattern of profound abuse, including excessive force, unlawful searches and seizures, discrimination, and the suppression of First Amendment rights. For a look at the details, we're joined by Judith Birkin. She's a professor of constitutional law at the Inter-American University in Puerto Rico, and she has worked on police misconduct cases for 30 years. She's in San Juan. Judith Birkin, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this report is comprehensive. It covers a number of areas. Let's begin with the police use of violence against protesters. What has this report found?
This report found what has been clear to those of us who practice in the area of civil rights in Puerto Rico, which is that police violence, which has many manifestations, has specifically been directed at protesters. It has been used as a means to dissuade and punish those who dare to exercise what are clearly constitutional rights to oppose the policies of the government in power.
So the report not only documents specific incidents, but that this violence is used to dissuade further protest?
Yes. I mean, the report talks about some specific incidences that were quite notorious here in Puerto Rico, including an event in the Hotel Sheraton in May of 2010, in which the second in charge of the police force kicked a young man in his genitals for holding up a sign, and the police then proceeded to tase him three times for holding up a sign. And that's just one incident. Another incident, which I represent several people who are suing the police in regards to this incident, occurred on June 30th of last year when the Senate of Puerto Rico closed the chambers to all visitors and people went out to protest because clearly in a democracy we should have access to what the legislative chamber is doing. And the protest, which was peaceful, was met with what I've characterized as a police riot. And the report confirms that in the sense that there was an indiscriminate use of pepper spray, helicopters to spray pepper spray over peaceful protesters, use of batons and shields to attack protesters. Dozens of people ended up in the hospital for having dared to go to the Capitol and express their inconformity with what the government was doing.
Well, I noticed in the report that it specifically does mention the use of chemical spray.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It was an aggressive use. It is directed at the eyes of people. It is unprovoked. It is frequent. And I should say, through my work in representing victims of civil rights abuses in Puerto Rico, it's not only in the context of political protests, but it's certainly that way, but there is an indiscriminate use on the street of pepper spray to as an aggressive means of controlling any situation that the police happen upon.
Another aspect that the report looks into is illegal searches and seizures without warrants, especially against protesters, workers, and journalists. It says that
yes.
The police, quote, routinely violated constitutional rights of residents of Puerto Rico. How widespread a problem is this?
Oh, this is incredibly widespread. This is not a recent development. There's a remarkable lack of training of the police who believe that they can intervene with anybody. In the housing projects of Puerto Rico, for example, the daily violations of the protections against illegal searches and seizure are remarkable and really go unpunished. And this is a problem that has been pointed out administration after administration in the police force, and it continues to be that way.
Judith Birkin is an attorney specializing in police misconduct. She joined us from San Juan to discuss a new report by the Department of Justice that has found widespread abuses in the Puerto Rico Police Department. Judith Birkin, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Over the last two decades, journalists in Kashmir have often found themselves on the receiving end of violent attacks, especially in the last several years as public protests have surged. But a recent case has reignited journalists' demand for humane treatment. FSRN's Shanawaz Khan reports.
At a recent demonstration in Srinagar, journalists gathered to condemn brutal attacks by security forces.
They should be honest. Either they say, okay, you have the freedom, you have the liberty to operate here, or they should say media is not required, so we don't allow media to function in the state.
The protesters were supporting two photojournalists who were badly beaten up and detained for hours in a police station after covering stone-hurling clashes between youth and police. One of the roughed-up photojournalists, Narciso Contreras, is a Mexican national on his first trip to Kashmir.
I showed them my ID pass, my press pass, and they start to beat me up really bad. After they drag me out from the shop and drag me all the way from there to the police station, beating me and kick me and doing everything with me. They pull out my back.
Narciso's ordeal continued in the police station.
They drag me from one office to other, and every police there, every person was into the police station beating me, you know, really bad.
Fellow journalists who came looking for them were also beaten. They were released after a few hours, but Contreras said police had taken more than $1,000 from his bag. Later that evening, local reporter Wasim Khalid was working on the story for his newspaper, Greater Kashmir.
When I tried to get the police court about the incident, I mean, I was threatened. I was told that if you will file such a report, you will face unimaginable consequences.
Khalid says that police have threatened him over the past several months.
Whenever I tried to get quotes of the officials, concerned officials, I was repeatedly, I mean, threatened. I was bullied and intimidated, and they told me that, I mean, most of the time they stopped me from filing stories, saying that they will entangle me in false cases, and I have to fight then long legal battles.
Last year, journalists had a difficult time covering news, especially if it involved police. A number of reporters were beaten up by police and their curfew passes cancelled repeatedly. While this has been a relatively peaceful year, journalists, especially photojournalists and cameramen, often find themselves at police's mercy. Muzamil Jalil, Srinagar bureau chief of the national daily Indian Express, did an investigative story last month on a 15-year-old incident involving murders with police complicity. As soon as the story appeared, authorities started intimidating Jalil.
I did a story recently. You know, it was a human rights violation which was committed. There were murders committed. Four people were kidnapped. Three of them were killed, and they were taken in a police vehicle. The weapons were given by the police. There were cases. I wrote whatever had come, you know, through the, you know, whatever come up through the investigation that the police themselves had done. And I found people outside my home. I found, you know, things happening which were creating an environment of fear, not only for me, but for my family as well.
Maneuvering between pulls, pressures and threats, Kashmiri journalists, however, go on reporting as much as are able to. They, along with press freedom groups, are calling on authorities to stop the attacks and protect journalists who cover demonstrations. Meanwhile, Mexican photojournalist Narciso Contreras has tried to file complaints with police and get them to return the $1,000 they took. But after several unsuccessful attempts, he is now leaving this week and says he hopes to get help from his embassy to investigate the attacks against him. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Following the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Sikh American community faced many of the same conditions as Muslims and Arab Americans. Sikhs make up the fifth largest religion in the world, and there are as many as 500,000 in the United States. Because of their distinct appearance, they were visible targets of violence and harassment. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Noor has more.
On September 11th, 2001, members of the Sikh American community mourned the day's tragic events, but they soon became concerned for their own safety. Sikhs wear turbans and have uncut beards, an appearance that some associate with terrorists. On that day, Sunny Singh was a 21-year-old college student at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
And honestly, before I even began to really let what was happening sink in and really understand what was happening and the tragedy of what was happening, I already felt fear about backlash.
Singh says while growing up in North Carolina, community members singled him out because of his appearance. but such incidents increased dramatically after the terrorist attacks.
You know, after 9/11, the bigotry and the harassment really just became a lot more intense. It went from being something that I'd experience every once in a while to something that I'd experience every day.
Across the country, Sikhs, along with others identified as Muslim, Arab, or South Asian, were targeted. Amardeep Singh, co-founder of the Sikh Coalition, a civil rights and advocacy group, said the attacks were immediate.
Once we received reports that members of the community in New York City were being physically attacked, in the cases of two members of the community chased in the streets near the World Trade Center site the morning of 9/11, we issued a press release the night of 9/11 saying the Sikh organizations of New York call on police to protect our community from hate crimes and grieve with the rest of the country.
Just 4 days later in Arizona, Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh immigrant from India, was shot and killed on his front lawn in what authorities said was a hate crime. Amardeep Singh criticizes law enforcement for not keeping hate crime statistics for the Sikh community.
There were two Sikh gentlemen in Elk Grove, California, who were shot and killed in what prosecutors believe was a hate crime. And those two men do not even have the dignity of being a statistic. And if you're not tracking a problem, how can you help solve it if you don't understand it?
Although physical attacks have since subsided, some Sikhs continue to face intimidation. 18-year-old Gurvinder Singh says he was often targeted at school.
You would expect to be called a terrorist. They would affiliate you with bin Laden. It made my education miserable, and I wouldn't focus on my education at all. I would just focus on, like, you know, being safe, and getting safe out of school and just get home.
In one incident, Singh said he was chased down and beaten by a classmate.
He basically ended up hitting my head into a pole. It was a metal pole, and I fell down on the ground at that moment because it really hurt.
Some advocates say the media has neglected covering discrimination against Sikhs, Muslims, and others following the September 11th attacks. Amardeep Singh wants media outlets to do more to combat the stereotypes and bigotry.
It's been 10 years, and we are 110% convinced that the mainstream media has done a woeful job of covering the stories of our community post 9/11.
To combat the lack of media coverage and to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the attacks, the Sikh Coalition partnered with other civil rights groups to launch the website Unheard Voices of 9/11. Using video and photos, it features the personal stories of people attacked, harassed, and discriminated against. Organizers say it's a way to have their stories also remembered on September 11th. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
As part of our coverage in commemoration of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, today we turn to Pakistan, where the U.S. government has carried out a controversial bombing campaign and where special forces killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden earlier this year. Pakistanis have endured rising levels of violence in the tribal areas and major cities over the last decade, and attention has grown to the situation of human rights in the country. To learn more, FSRN's Claudia Craig spoke to Nobel Peace Prize nominee and human rights lawyer Asma Jahangir. She's also president of the Supreme Court Bar Association and chair of Pakistan's Human Rights Commission.
How has Pakistan changed since September the 11th? That the people you come across in your job, in your human rights work, what do they say?
For all of us, things have worsened. Not that September 11th, you know, when it happened that we had not seen terrorism at close quarters here. We already knew, we had already experienced it. People outside of Pakistan or in the West woke up to it with September 11th. But some of us had hoped that September 11th has woken up the whole world to this new kind of terrorism, which is an international terrorism based on an ideology, if I may say so. But it is terrorism. That something would be done so that this can be gradually sort of, there can be a reduction in this. But unfortunately for us, things have become worse. It has been so badly mishandled.
And I wonder what the recent slaying of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, what kind of effect that has had.
Frankly, I don't think it has had much impact on the ordinary person here. That is what I feel. I hardly hear anybody discuss it.
And so do you believe that the Obama administration and the U.S. Congress should now make a high priority of accepting some level of accountability for them, for the U.S. Contraventions in human rights with regard to Pakistan? I'm talking here about civilian deaths, torture, civil liberties.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's all disappearances actually started from there. I mean, I can trace you down the very first disappearance that took place, and then it started in numbers, was when the Musharraf government started to take people and hand them over to the U.S. And then when the U.S. got them and didn't sort of, turn a blind eye to what we call disappearance, so they felt that if they could do it for them, they could help themselves do it too. And the numbers became huge.
And that brings us to a different point, but related, which is the question of the U.S. and drone strikes. The present government, Zardari's government, now is insisting for equal say with the U.S. over drone strikes. This compares with the acquiescence or the apparent acquiescence of the Musharraf government. There was the U.S. strike in October 2006 on the Chennai Madrasa that killed 82 people, at which point the Pakistani military was apparently ordered to take complete responsibility.
But, well, if you look at international law, the UN rapporteur on extrajudicial killings has said drone strikes are illegal. So there cannot be two opinions about it. So there is a lurking fear that this will continue. And plus, simply, it is a violation of international law.
Do you think the policies of the Pakistani government since 9/11 in the last 10 years, that of both Musharraf and Zardari, have been successful or not in protecting the citizens properly, particularly women, religious minorities and children, from violence and other human rights abuses?
Well, obviously, they have not been successful. I mean, the figures will tell you that. The rise in violence will tell you that. The fear amongst the population will tell you that. The fact that a lot of people who can leave the country is telling you that. Minorities have fled, and that will tell you that they are not safe here. I do hope that the U.S. doesn't intervene, because what they have done so far to our country, I think that is enough for us.
Well, Madam Jahangir, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
That was Pakistani human rights lawyer Asma Jahangir speaking to FSRN's Claudia Cragg. And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.